The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's good to have you with us on this last show of the week. Where has the week gone? We're back into full swing with the new semester at Herbert W. Armstrong College, so it's been a busy, busy week, and of course, lots going on in the news. As always, yesterday's show, by the way, after we put the finishing touches on that and got the podcast ready to get posted, we titled that program, Upside Down World, Trump is the Racist, and Ramaphosa, that's the South African leader, he inspires hope, to paraphrase what Barack Obama said just a little over a month ago. Upside down, Trump's the racist, and then the South African leader, he's inspiring people. Well, following that show, as if right on cue, the front page story. This is from the front page of the New York Times today, and it says, Trump's South Africa tweet seems to embrace racist narrative on land dispute. So the New York Times is there to inform us that, as you would expect, Donald Trump is the racist. He's the racist. He sends out a tweet about farmers being killed in South Africa, about land being confiscated, taken away from white farmers. He sends out one tweet, and as I mentioned yesterday, the uproar is over his tweet, not over what's happening in South Africa. This is from the New York Times. It says, when Mr. Trump announced Wednesday night that he was directing his Secretary of State to scrutinize what he said was the targeting of white farmers for land seizures and large-scale killing in South Africa, the president waded into a complex and politically charged debate. It says, and in doing that, he embraced a common talking point among white supremacists who claim white genocide is being perpetrated in South Africa and around the world. So he said something that evidently a white supremacist site has said or commented on, and so that makes him a white supremacist. Guilt by association. He's obviously associated with these groups, and so he's guilty just like they are. It says here in the New York Times, the presidential tweet on Wednesday appeared to be the culmination of a lengthy lobbying effort by a right-wing South African group that falsely claims that white farmers are being systematically forced off their land and killed in large numbers. Well, I mean, the news this week is that Parliament has voted by overwhelming majority that we can now begin confiscating land from white farmers. And the fact that dozens upon dozens of farmers are being killed every year, I mean, that's undeniable. It's been happening since 1994 when the communists took over, when the ANC, the communist ANC party took over. South Africa has been under communist government for going on 25 years, and it's suffering. They can't get enough money now with all these socialist programs. And so as a last resort, now they're going to take the land from the white farmers, thinking that this will fix all of their problems. Well, the ANC, the ruling party, they had a response to Donald Trump's tweet on Wednesday. And the ANC said, the biggest mistake that we're making is to consult murderers. White people are 9% of the population, and they own 79% of the land. They never came and consulted us for the land. If they want us to forgive them now, then Let us share the land, the mineral resources. They say the biggest mistake that they've made is to consult with murderers, referring to the whites in South Africa. And so you get a few newspapers, maybe the Daily Mail. I don't even know of really many others that point out this kind of racism going on. But the only racism that the mainstream see is from Donald Trump and some of these white supremacist groups who are saying that farmers are being killed in South Africa, and now their land's going to be taken away without compensation. And, of course, the government has announced that this week. We now have the right, because we've changed our constitution, we now have the right to confiscate land without giving any kind of compensation. In this New York Times article, talking about the farmers being killed, it says the number of killings of farmers, including farm workers in South Africa, is at a 20-year low. So it's pretty good, the New York Times says. Only 47 people over the last year have been murdered, farmers. Farmers and farm workers, only 47 have been murdered this past year. And that's down from 66 the year before. And even better, I mean, if you go back to the mid to late 1990s, it was like 150 to 200 that were being killed or murdered every year. And so really, I mean, we're seeing improvement. Of course, what they don't say, what they don't bring out, is that there's not as many farmers in South Africa anymore. We had an article back in 2014. I mean, these stats are a little bit outdated, but we noted at the Trumpet that in 1980, there were 128,000 commercial farmers in South Africa, and that today there's 40,000, and that's from 2014. Who knows how many there are right now in 2018? And then you have all of the... I mean, where else do you hear... What other nation, even a nation as big as the United States, maybe I'll get this wrong since I haven't done the research, but I mean, you certainly don't see it in the news. You know, some Joe Schmo farmer in Iowa that gets murdered. Even 47, if that is the figure from this past year, 47, and then now the government comes out and says, we're going to start taking farms from the whites. So as soon as President Trump tweets it, look, it's bad. It's bad in South Africa. Then the automatic knee-jerk reaction from the New York Times is that, no, it's good. Everything's swell. Everything's going great. That's the New York Times today. The New York Times in April, this is 4 months ago, it said the African National Congress, this is the New York Times editorial board, this is the paper of record's official position, the editorial board at the New York Times, they said in April, just 4 months ago, that the African National Congress that Nelson Mandela led to a triumphant victory over apartheid a quarter century ago has become gorged on corruption. The ANC... The communist ANC party, gorged on corruption, so said the New York Times in April. It went on to say, what is particularly galling is that so many of the millions filched from state coffers were earmarked to lift up the poor left behind by apartheid. While politically connected companies and individuals have grown wealthy, the gap between them and the poor, most of them blacks, has only grown. This is the New York Times 4 months ago saying, you know, it's getting worse in South Africa. And the ANC is not helping it because they're gorged with corruption. So they got rid of the Western Christian white government in 1994. And they voted in the godless leave aside race for a moment. I don't even say why. They got rid of the Western Christian government in 1994, and then they welcomed the godless communist government. And then we're 25 years on from it, and we come to find out that it's not helping matters. It's getting worse. And, of course, you have to be very careful with how you talk about it, or else there's going to be an outrage of response, a flood of response. Outraged that Donald Trump would weigh in on something like this and say, hey, there's killings going on, mass killings, in fact, in South Africa. But back in April, like I say, there was a fair bit more truth to the Times assessment. It says the potential for change was evident when the ANC finally forced President Jacob Zuma out of office in February. Mr. Zuma's 9 years in office were a byword for obscene corruption, and he now faces corruption, racketeering, fraud, and money laundering charges. That's the previous leader in South Africa. His successor, Cyril Ramaphosa, this is the current leader, the one that came in campaigning on the fact that we're going to confiscate white farmland or farmland owned by the whites. He promised that this is Ramaphosa earlier this year. This is the year in which we will turn the tide of corruption in our public institutions. And then the New York Times in April said, yet President Ramaphosa is himself a veteran ANC member and made a fortune largely through his ties to the party. And his cabinet includes officials who stand accused of corruption. So it's just corrupt from top to bottom. There is no solution in man. There is no government, no leader in South Africa that's making it better for its people, whether white or black. How is this better for black people in South Africa? I mean, even carrying out this land grab like what happened in Zimbabwe. You take the land from a farmer and then give it to the blacks, in many cases, blacks who aren't into farming. We saw it in Zimbabwe. Now, again, Ramaphosa keeps saying it's not going to be like Zimbabwe. We're going to do it different. And that's what they often say. This time it'll be different. And you see the same actions, the same course. It's like I said yesterday. We're going down the same path, the same mistakes over and over again. And a large part of the reason that they just get worse is that we won't confront these problems. We won't admit what the real problem is. I mean, the big story, following the tweet anyway, is, well, what is really happening in South Africa? I mean, one side says it's really bad. And then the other side says, no, it's gotten much better. It's gotten much better since 1994. And so the argument is over what's the truth. And the truth is pretty much cast to the ground. Mr. Trump takes a lot of heat for the tweet. And then, like I played yesterday, the Tucker Carlson segment from Wednesday night, he takes a lot of heat now, too, because President Trump sent out the tweet following that segment that he viewed on Fox News Wednesday night. And so Tucker Carlson last night, I mean, he had to come out and defend his segment from the previous evening. Here's what he had to say last night, clip one.
Pushing back against racial discrimination is always worth doing. And yet for some reason, a reason no one really explained, luminaries in the media disagreed. They were offended by that. In an Orwellian turn, various news outlets suggested it was somehow racist to oppose the racist policies of the South African government, even Nazi-like. Watch.
He goes to race, and what better way than to give this neo-Nazi propaganda that white farmers are being killed in South Africa, when in fact that is not true, not based on them being white.
So show that clip to anyone who knows South Africa, who lives there, and see how they respond. They'll laugh bitterly. It's ludicrous. It's a lie. The president of the country, Cyril Ramaphosa, has pledged to change South Africa's constitution in order to legalize the seizure of property without compensation. that's currently being debated in the parliament in South Africa. Even now, the government is trying to confiscate two game farms after the owners refused to sell at a fraction of the market price. Everyone in the country understands what these are. They're racial attacks.
They're racial attacks, and people in South Africa understand this well. Like he said, I mean, you play that clip from Al Sharpton, and South African residents would laugh at that. There's no killings going on, and the real neo-Nazis here are Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump. And meanwhile, the racial attacks are intensifying. He went on to say, this is Tucker Carlson last night, clip two.
Now our elites endorse the idea of a racial spoils system. And that's the scariest part. It's far more ominous than whatever the corrupt and incompetent government of South Africa is doing. Our ruling class now believes in collective punishment. That is the opposite of justice. Nobody is alleging that individual farm owners in South Africa stole their land. Instead, the claim is that people who resemble them did, and that's enough. Our elites see no problem with that standard. That should worry you a lot. If you got mugged, how would you feel about imprisoning someone who just happened to look like the mugger? How about the mugger's children? Should they be punished too? If those sound like insane questions, that's because they are insane questions. In the West, we punish only the guilty. We do not punish their descendants or everyone with the same hair and eye color. For more than 200 years, pretty much everybody in America agreed on those terms. Now, the people who run our country aren't so sure. Increasingly, they think that generational guilt seems like a fine standard. But where does that end up?
That's Tucker Carlson last night talking about what's really scary, more scary than this corrupt government in South Africa, is Western elites and their embrace of this so-called generational guilt. White farmers who've perhaps been on their farm for 3, 4, 5 generations, who knows how long, but they're guilty, and their farms are going to be taken away, seized, confiscated. Where does this end up? Well, it's leading to race war. And it's not limited to South Africa alone. The spirit behind all of this, it's Revelation 12. Revelation 12 and verse 9. You can see Satan just whipping up anger and resentment and hatred and violence. Julius Malema, we played that clip for you yesterday. I said it was from earlier this year. It was actually from 2016, and this is not just, as Carlson even pointed out, it's not a fringe figure in the political scene in South Africa. This is a popular leader. He's heading up the EFF party in South Africa, which it's a communist party, and it's the third largest political party in the country. And this young man is wildly popular among young people. They love his message. They love it when he talks about killing whites. This is not some rapper singing about it. This is a political leader, a politician, a communist leader at that, following in the line of Nelson Mandela. We played this clip yesterday. We'll just play it one more time here, clip three.
I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I'm saying to you, we've not called for the killing of white people, at least for now. I can't guarantee the future.
Yeah, but I mean, you'd understand somebody watching that, especially as it gets shared on Twitter, they freak out. It sounds like a genocidal call.
Cry babies. Cry babies.
I'm not calling for the slaughter of white people, at least for now.
I can't give you a guarantee of the future, especially when things are going the way they are.
Subtext.
Especially if things are going the way they are, there will be a revolution in this country, I can tell you now. There will be an alert revolution. An alert revolution is the highest form of anarchy.
So when the highest, if they don't get what they want, an unled revolution, the highest form of anarchy, I mean, does this help whites or blacks? Does this make South Africa? South Africa used to be one of the freest, one of the most prosperous, one of the most peaceful nations in Africa. It was not that long ago. And even though the major media will not cover it today, it's gotten so much worse since 1994, so much more dangerous. The economy's tanked. You have the, as you've been seeing, or at least you've been hearing on this program, you have farmers fearful for their lives. We're not calling for the killing of white people, at least not yet. But if we don't get what we want, that's what he's saying. If we don't get what we want, we're going to call for the killing of white people. And you look into the history of that nation, the last few centuries, and you can get a pretty good idea of what's coming. You do have to go back a few centuries. I mean, the history of South Africa, a lot of people want us to believe that the history of South Africa began when the Dutch and the British colonialists showed up. And there's some history even before that that we need to be honest about and straightforward about. It's not to suggest that the white government was perfect by any means, or that the apartheid system was fair in every respect. But it's getting worse, and it's going to hurt whites and blacks. It's going to be painful for whites and blacks in the end. This is Malema from just a few months ago, earlier this year, clip 4.
When you want to hit them hard, go after a white man. They feel a terrible pain. We are starting with this whiteness. We are cutting the throat of whiteness.
That's just a political campaign speech from earlier this year, 2018. The leader of the EFF Communist Party. When you want to hit them hard, go after the white man. Go after him. We're starting with this whiteness. We're cutting the throat of whiteness. That's what he said earlier this year. He also had some comments yesterday in response to President Trump's tweet. This is what he said just yesterday, clip 5.
Donald Trump is not saying anything we have not heard from white people. There's a group of white right-wingers who are being trained by Jews in Pretoria to be snipers. Only death will stop us. Not Trump, not poverty, not sanctions.
That's Malema's response to President Trump's tweet. The problem here are the right-wingers that are trained by the Jews and the neo-Nazis, the Jews and the white nationalists, the white supremacists. I mean, Donald Trump's not saying anything we haven't heard before from white people. We're accustomed to this, but they're not going to stop us. Only death will stop us. We're ready to fight to the death. That's Julius Malema. He was the one calling for the confiscation of white-owned farms back in February. Ramaphosa, as I say, he came on board earlier this year with that as part of his campaign. Ramaphosa he's talked about the taking of the land from the indigenous people of South Africa, that's the nation's original sin. In other words, well, the whites took it from the blacks, so to get rid of that original sin, we've got to take it back from the whites. And that's the way that many are reasoning today. That's how they justify it, and that's why the major media won't cover the story, because in their heart of hearts, they believe that the blacks are entitled to take it back, to take it for themselves. And even that is a gross misrepresentation of South Africa's actual history. This claim that, well, it was white settlers that stole the land. I mean, when the Dutch came in there in the 1600s, the Cape Colony was mostly uninhabited. There's this documentary in here. This will again, as far as those that are trying to whitewash all of this and really conceal the truth of what's happening in South Africa, I'm sure they would look at the producer or the people behind this documentary and say, well, they're coming again. They've said statements similar to a white supremacist group, so they're in that same group. with all those groups and President Trump. But I just want for you to listen to some of the history. We've written about this before. In fact, when I heard the, I haven't watched the entirety of this documentary, but the history is covered in the first 10 or 12 minutes. And when I went through it this morning, after having read through Robert Morley's piece from The Trumpet back in July 2010, I thought, well, wow, this documentary maker probably read Robert Morley's piece because he covered some excellent history, some important history, some history that we can't just erase and then pretend like South African history started with the arrival of the British or that it started in 1948. There's more to the story. And this whole summer, I mean, we've been emphasizing the importance of being grounded in history. I mean, the farther we can look back into it, the more we can see ahead. We can see what's coming. We can see the clash that's coming between, leave aside Bible prophecy, but we can see what's coming. I mean, in some cases, like in the case of Malema, I mean, they're telling you what's coming. They're telling you where this is headed. In any event, here is this documentary. I think it just came out this year. It's called Farmland. And here is this host taking you back to the 1600s and some important history just to understand and to grasp the context here. This is clip six.
It all begins in 1652 when the Dutch East India Company, or the VOC, became the first European group to establish a permanent settlement on South Africa's western coast. At this time, the rest of the country was inhabited only by the Khoisan people, an ancient nomadic group who forged the land long before the black tribes migrated south into the modern-day KwaZulu-Natal. The VOC made its first purchase of land from the Khoisan people in 1671, establishing the Cape Colony in the areas surrounding what would become Cape Town. But it did not treat all under its rule well, and many children of the settlers were born into indentured servitude. Seeking a life beyond the VOC, a group known as the Trekboer set out beyond the borders of the Cape Colony in search of a free, semi-nomadic farming life in the country's interior. They were joined by the first of the Voortrekkers in 1836, a larger group that would eventually form the basis of South Africa's modern Afrikaner population. As their great trek reached its peak, war erupted among the Bantu tribes in the north, as they migrated across the modern South African border. In 1816, a king named Shaka ascended to the Zulu throne. Within a year, he had conquered almost all of the neighboring tribes who were vying for control of the region. This period is known as the Mfukane, the Zulu word for crushing, scattering, or forced migration.
So that brings us up to the 1800s thereabouts. She refers to the Mfukane and this Zulu leader, Shaka. And so if you go back to the July 2010 trumpet, this was Robert Morley writing about, this was when South Africa hosted the World Cup, I believe. And of course, as is often the case, you watch all of these soccer matches and then you see all the special features about how great the country is. And what Mr. Morley is doing here is showing that, you know, while they might put a good face on it, you have to look at what's happening on the ground. So before discussing that, he goes through some of this history, this Mfukane. He says here, the beginnings of South Africa's simmering tension extend back more than 200 years to a time when the nation was first being conquered, but not by white people. Historians refer to this period in African history as the Mfukane, what she just mentioned there in that documentary clip. It's a word deeply associated with one of the most feared personalities in African history, if not the world. It still sends chills down the spines of those who understand its connotation. It's a Zulu expression that means the crushing, the scattering, the time of the crushing or the slaughter, he says, was one of the bloodiest in African history. Southern Africa was engulfed in tribal war from south of what is now Lesotho and Durban on the eastern coast of South Africa all the way up into Zimbabwe and Mozambique. The land was being systematically depopulated. And this filmmaker goes on into that in just a moment. I might play another clip a little bit later, but Robert Morley says here, Shaka Zulu, the Zulu king, was sweeping away all who opposed him. He introduced new weapons and new methods of warfare, including terror and scorched earth destruction, which induced mass starvation. Rival tribes either submitted or were massacred. When a clan was overrun, the young men would be conscripted into the army, the young women taken for the harems, and the rest either slaughtered or sold as slaves. In just 4 years, Shaka conquered an area larger than France. This was happening in the 1800s. He conquered an area bigger than France. It says, at the height of his power, Shaka could field over 50,000 trained warriors, many of whom could run 40 miles before fighting a battle. Over 100,000 warriors from related tribes also answered his call. The ferocity of Shaka's expansion set mass migrations in place as other tribes fled. Mass migrations in place, he says, as other tribes fled. This sparked even more warfare and conflict, which only weakened those who sought to oppose him. And then Robert Morley concludes, at least this bit here, he says, an estimated 2 million Africans died from Shaka's crushing and scattering. Again, the so-called Mfukane. I can't say that great, but in any event, the crushing. 2 million people, an estimated 2 million. Then what Shaka started, years of drought and food shortages, finished. It was into this atmosphere of panic, migration, and depopulation that the Dutch and French voortrekkers arrived, the VOC, as she mentioned there in the documentary. So this is what they arrived to, this kind of civil war, I guess you could call it that, or tribal warfare, where people were being systematically slaughtered. This was just 2 centuries ago. Some important history to consider. Now, along the way, as is explained in this documentary, I mean, that violence also then spread into black on white and white on black, going back over the past couple of centuries. But when you look at this history, when you look at South Africa today, and when you look at this concerted effort to conceal the truth, to cover the truth, to deceive, like I was saying yesterday, many in the media, they know this. They know what's happening. But they're concealing it. It's like the New York Times. They get pretty close to the truth in an editorial back in April because the corruption, I mean, it's so bad and people are suffering. And as long as it's just about that, you know, we'll maybe give you a bit of truth there. But as soon as our political opponent, as soon as he tweets something out, well, we are going to rush to the defense of South Africa. We are going to rush to the defense of Ramaphosa. We are going to pretend that the killings aren't happening, that the murders aren't taking place, that the farms aren't being confiscated. Truth, you see, truth. It's cast to the ground. The big story is the fight over, well, what's true and what isn't true? Instead of just looking at what's happening, what's right in front of our faces, and confronting it. And dealing with it. When we come back, I'll see if I can get another clip or two from that documentary, Farmland. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
Oh, my God.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
In 1823, a rebellion under Mzilikazi split off from the Zulus and headed north into the Transvaal region, where it is estimated between 1 and 2 million Bantu people were massacred, leaving the area almost completely depopulated. It was during this time that several tribes, the Mfengu and the Ngwane among them, were forced to flee south, putting them on a direct course for the trekking Boer. This was unfortunate for the Boer, who had been making deals with smaller tribes in the area, trading favors, livestock, and weaponry for land. These deals between the Boer and the Bantu occurred frequently throughout South Africa's history. It wasn't long, though, until fair and mostly peaceful exchanges of land between whites and blacks gave way to violent militaristic ones. In 1828, a new Zulu king, Dingane, took the throne. Piet Retief, a notable Voortrek leader, was determined to make civil deals with the tribes. He was granted land for his caravan of Voortrekkers in exchange for the return of 700 cows that had been stolen by a neighboring tribe. After returning these cows to the Zulu, Retief and his trekkers made settlements on the agreed-upon land. And in a show of good faith, the king invited Retief and a band of his men to witness a special performance put on by his soldiers. There was no show. Instead, the soldiers restrained Retief and marched him and 100 of his men to a bridge where they were beaten to death, leaving Retief for last, so he would be forced to watch the murder of his men and his son before he himself was killed. Dingane went on to massacre Retief's entire encampment, including hundreds of women, children, and many Khoisan people who had traveled alongside the Voortrekkers. The incident became known as the Winen Massacre. While the Boer advance across the country was mostly peaceful, the Bantu tribes fought ceaselessly, killing white, black, and Khoisan people wherever they found them.
That's another clip there from the documentary Farmland, talking about what was happening in the 1800s, this clash of all these tribes, and then, of course, the racial clashes as well. Going back to that July 2010 trumpet article by Robert Morley, just to back up a little bit from the period she just spoke of, It says here from Mr. Morley, 150 years before, in 1652, the first Dutch settled into the Cape Town region. And then Morley writes, but by 1806, Britain had permanently seized the colony to keep it from falling to Napoleon. Unhappy with British rule, the Dutch and French farmers, known as Boers, began migrating east and north right into the aftermath of the Zulu annihilation. Okay, you heard some about that in the clip there. It says the Boers found something else during their migration, some of the most fertile agricultural land in the world, and it wasn't being used for farming. It was just sitting there, basically. And it was this fertile land. Now, again, another dimension to this history that God's people are well aware of is the prophecy regarding the blessings to be bestowed upon the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh and the acquisition of important sea gates around the world, of which one is Cape Town, that southern tip of South Africa. Well, they see this fertile farmland. It says, to many of the religiously devout Boers, it was as if God had just bequeathed to them the richest agricultural inheritance possible. For a society of farmers technically under the British Empire's authority, the vast open range and farmland seemed like the greatest of blessings. In fact, it was an even greater blessing than they imagined. Decades later, the land was found to contain the richest gold, platinum, chromium, and diamond deposits in the world. It says by the end of World War II, South Africa was 100% self-sufficient. The land not only supplied the nation's every need, but it also provided vast food and technology exports for other African nations. So that brings it up more to our modern era. But just going back to the 1800s and this clash in 1832, you heard a bit about it in that that clip I just played, but let me just read a little more of it from Robert Morley's article from 2010. It says by 1832, after skirmishes with other tribes, the Boers came face to face with the Zulu kingdom. 3 years earlier, Shaka, after committing tribal atrocities against his own people, was murdered by two of his brothers, one of whom then took the throne. The Boers offered a peace treaty to the new king, Dingaan. He was mentioned in that clip that I just played. And then Robert goes on to explain how that in response to this peace offer, Dingaan says, well, sure, come to this celebration. And the Boer leaders, again, these Dutch farmers, the Boer leaders are brought to this great celebration where they are then massacred, killed at this bridge, like you heard, and all of these Zulus shouting, kill the wizards, kill them. It says the warriors jumped onto the shocked Boers, quickly overpowering and dragging them up the hill where they clubbed and hacked them to death. It says one after the other, so that the awaiting victims were forced to watch. The Zulu king then dispatched his army to attack the approaching unsuspecting settler wagons. Over 500 men, women, and children were speared to death that night. It says the climax of the Zulu-Boer War came in 1838 at the Battle of Blood River. Well, I won't take the time to just go through all the history because I do want to try to finish today's show by bringing it right up to speed or right up to today. But you should go back and read that article by Robert Morley because he talks about this miraculous victory the Boers obtained in 1838 where, once again, they went head-to-head against the Zulus. And they didn't lose one soldier, and they credited this victor. They gave God the credit. They gave glory to God for this incredible victory. December 16th, I think it was, 1838. Well, as I say, I won't take the time to just bore you with all, no pun intended, with all of these details. But make sure that you search at thetrumpet.com for Robert Morley's piece, Outside the Stadium. Again, he was writing that during the World Cup from back in July of 2010. Outside the Stadium has some of this fascinating history right there for you at thetrumpet.com. One final clip, and this is a longer one, but as I say, it will bring you then right up to the present day, or at least the present day government in South Africa, the ANC. Here's one final bit from the documentary Farmland, clip 8.
In 1910, following the surrender of the Boer to the British, the Union of South Africa was formed. It comprised all of the now established colonies and united them as one legislative union. For a time, separation of blacks and whites was only a social convention, not the rigidly enforced legal structure it came to be. But after the election of the National Party in 1948, what we now know today as apartheid, a word that quite literally means separateness, was formally introduced across South Africa. A slew of new laws, including bans on mixed-race marriages and the Population Registration Act, which required people to register as black, white, colored, or Indian, were all introduced. And many of the descendants of the Bantu tribes were moved to the Bantustan areas, known today as the Black Tribal Homelands. In all aspects of life, blacks and whites became separated, often almost entirely. In the 1970s and 80s, apartheid became the focus of a global pushback. The UN brought sanctions, while internal resistance to apartheid began to find greater support. In the face of both peaceful and violent resistance, the National Party began a brutal crackdown. The crackdown only radicalized South Africa's anti-apartheid activists even further. In 1961, Nelson Mandela, then a member of the South African Communist Party, co-founded the Spear of the Nation, the armed wing of the African National Congress that rules the country today. The group, often abbreviated to MK, publicly announced its existence with 57 bombings on one day. Ultimately, with the help of the CIA, Mandela was arrested and spent the next 27 years in prison. During this time, the resistance to apartheid only became more radical. In 1986, Mandela's wife Winnie publicly endorsed the new trend of necklacing, a form of execution used against blacks thought to be collaborating with the government. They would be forced to wear a rubber tire filled with petrol around their chest or necks before being set ablaze. Eventually, following international pressure and the fear of a race-based civil war, the National Party released Mandela and entered into negotiations with the African National Congress, formally ending apartheid in 1991. 3 years later, Mandela led the party to victory in South Africa's first multiracial election, securing his presidency and bringing about a new constitution, emphasizing racial reconciliation. South Africa is a young democracy, and the country still faces great obstacles, like deciding who has the right to parts of land still owned by the Afrikaner minority, something that has come to be known as the land issue, and which is tied closely to attacks on farmers. It is this divided South Africa that I am stepping into today.
So that's this gal, I failed to write down her name, but that's how she sets up her her documentary, which I think is about an hour and 15 minutes. I haven't seen the last hour of it, but the first, as I said earlier, the first 10 or 12 minutes, it aligns pretty closely with some of that history that Robert Morley was covering back in 2010. And even before that, just in skimming through the booklet by Ron Fraser that we produced, I think back in 1998, a great little booklet. If you look at that, South Africa in Prophecy, it's one of our older booklets, but he's writing that just following the ANC coming to power. I mean, she says it's a democracy, and it is. It's like it's a democracy, like I said yesterday, an absolute democracy. I mean, the majority rules, and the majority wants to take the land back. So they're beginning that process. But the government itself, it's really more communist in form, a socialist government. And in fact, Mandela, if you look at what he said back in, I think this was from 1994, when he promised, oh, I had it here somewhere. Where was this quote from? Well, basically, he was just promising this communist utopia. And Ramaphosa has said some of the same things here of late. I played that clip for you yesterday, the exchange between that fellow from the Cato Institute when he was talking to Tucker Carlson, saying that Ramaphosa is saying there's going to be a Garden of Eden utopia. And that's exactly what Mandela was promising back in the mid-1990s, and it hasn't happened. He said he was going to usher in this new era of peace and prosperity, and it has not happened. And so they've run out of ideas, and as a last resort, they've got to seize the land of the white farmers, thinking that that will fix all of the problems. This is the important context or perspective that you need and that you're just not going to get when turning on CNN or reading the New York Times. Sometimes, as I said earlier, I mean, the Times might get a few of the facts right if there's not a hotly contested political debate going on. But once politics is inserted into it, I mean, you know which side they're going to come down on. If the president of the United States says he's for it, then the major media, they're against it. And if he says he's against it, they're all for it. And meanwhile, truth is sacrificed. It's buried. It falls to the ground. The prophet Isaiah, he says in chapter 5, verse 15, "And the mean man shall be brought down, and the mighty man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled." I mean, we're all about to be humbled and brought down low. It says, "But the Eternal of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God that is holy shall be sanctified in righteousness." I mean, you would think both sides, all sides, would be looking to God more. The kinds of things that man is doing to fellow man. The hatred, the violence, the division. I mean, people, famous or leading politicians, calling for mass killings. That's the world today. That's 2018. And then these media voices that want to justify that sort of thing and say that, well, it's justified because of past wrongs. And so how are we going to fix it? Well, we're just going to judge the descendants of whatever happened 200-400 years ago, the descendants of all of them. They're guilty. They're guilty just because they look like their ancestors. Verse 20, it says, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, and put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." Woe unto them. I mean, if they're going to look at a situation that is obviously evil and corrupt and dangerously violent and say, no, it's pretty good, everything's fine, that's not going to solve the problem. God sees it. How does he assess the situation? When he looks at South Africa, when he looks at our cities in America, what does he see? He sees the wickedness of man, that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. That's the problem, white or black. Sin is the problem, and that's what Mr. Fraser addressed in that booklet back in 1998. I mean, it was given to the descendants of Ephraim as a blessing, as a gift from God. And then it was taken away because of our sins, because of the sins of Ephraim and Manasseh. That's the truth of it. And you would think that the former government of South Africa, you would think that the present government of South Africa, given all of these problems, that they look to God. It says in verse 21, this is the next verse, "Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. Woe unto us," it says, if we trust in self, if we trust in man, if we trust in a political party, if we trust in this particular group, this tribe, this whatever, and we don't look to God, well, this is what's coming. Robert Morley, at the end of that article, he says, you look at the history, you look at the prophecy, and another umfukane is coming. This shattering, it's coming again, and it's, as I said, it's going to go far beyond the borders of just South Africa. Jesus said, well, John did about him, that this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds are evil. That's John 3 in verse 19. Go back and look at that prophecy in Isaiah 5. And as I said earlier, make sure that you look for that article at thetrumpet.com by Robert Morley from 2010, outside the stadium. And then also, it'd be a good time, given the news this week, it'd be a good time to review Ron Fraser's booklet from 1998, South Africa in Prophecy. Well, that's all that we have time for today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to contact the program, you can send emails to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.